Hello everyone and welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm David Chen and with me are...
Devendra Hardwire.
Jeff Kanata.
And Christy Pechko.
Welcome to the show, everyone. You can find more episodes of this podcast at SlashFilmcast.com. Email us at SlashFilmcast@gmail.com. Today we're going to be discussing what we've been watching. We've got a bunch of stuff to talk about there. And talk about Stubbs A-List as well, which is something we brought up a week or two ago. And talk about our experience using that, because that's kind of helped us to watch a lot of things we've been watching. And then if we have time, we'll do a Slash Film Court and then move on into an in-depth review. This week we'll be reviewing Ant-Man and the Wasp. But before we get to any of that, I would say that we got a lot of positive feedback on the last episode of the podcast. More positive feedback than, I don't know, than we've gotten in recent memory. I think people really enjoyed that episode.
We've forgotten what it was like.
I forgot what it was like to be loved. Yeah. It's amazing.
More people. So many people were like, you know what's great about your show is when you review five movies instead of one.
Yeah, do that every week,
yeah,
please.
Do that more, please. Please do that more. Really appreciate everyone who listened to our Mission Impossible retrospective. We had so much fun doing it, and I would say, you know, a lot of people said, oh, well, you should do retrospectives more often. I think the Mission Impossible franchise kind of hits this, this kind of sweet spot, right?
Yeah.
Where it is kind of very, it's like mass entertainment. But it also has enough going there in terms of, you know, all the different directors to give film geeks something to geek out about. Has a lot of action in it that's really quality. And it's like starring a huge major star that as a result of that, you know, many people have seen those films.
Yeah. And right? it spans decades.
Yeah, it's over 25 years of movies. Man. It's crazy. It's one series over 25 years with the same star. It's a kind of a unique little unicorn in the world.
What I'm trying to say, and I'm not doing a very good job of saying it, is I think if we did like a Fast and Furious retrospective, I don't think it would be quite as well received. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, like, I disagree with that, but...
Also, I would be 100% in for that. I'm just saying.
It's also a 20-plus year franchise. With a world-renowned star, the D's? Come on.
That's like took a few movies off
and then came back.
Yeah.
But, okay, Fast and Furious is a bad example. But you know what I mean? Like, I guess it's just
like
not
Transformers.
That, yeah, Transformers. those have been pretty popular.
I'm busy that week.
I guess I just don't feel like there's that many franchises that A, would have that much interest, and B, that we'd actually enjoy talking about for that.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? So... That said, if you have any ideas, do feel free to email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. We'd be interested in hearing them.
Daniel Craig Bond movies. Let's do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing. It's like there is usually it's hard for a franchise to maintain like a consistently high quality of film, you know?
Yeah.
And usually there is a sharp fall off after number three, if not by number three. So Mission Impossible, one of the few franchises that is has consistently been excellent or at least very interesting. All that said. There were a few things that we missed in our review last week. We got a bunch of tweets, got a bunch of emails, and there's a few things that, looking back on that episode, I'm like, oh, man, I really wish we had mentioned that. One of the things that we didn't mention was Brian De Palma. We talked a little bit about him and kind of the overall noirish feel of Mission Impossible 1, but I forgot to mention some of the hallmarks of Brian De Palma that really make his movies his own. There's a bunch of split diopter shots in the movie, right?
Yeah.
Which basically, I don't think you really see those in any of the other films, or you rarely see them. Split diopter shots, basically, for those who don't know, is...
It's that crazy part where Tom Cruise is on the train and then that split diopter almost gets him.
The split diopter
explodes in the tunnel and then...
Pretty rough, Jeff.
No?
No, I'm giving that a slow clap. Maybe a slower one.
But it's something you'd find in like 70s movies, which kind of shows like the pedigree working on that movie. Yeah,
right. It basically is like you have objects or characters in frame on left and right side of the frame, and they're very like far away from each other. So one's very far away from the camera, one's very close, but they're both in focus. It's a very like stylistic choice to have them both in focus. And you need to use what's called a split diopter to achieve that effect, or a diopter to achieve that effect. A lot of those shots in Mission Impossible 1 and really kind of make it very distinctive. Another thing that I love in Brian De Palma movies is point of view shots. There's like a bunch of point of view shots in that movie, like when he first gets to the embassy or whatever in the first mission, and later on when he gets the sack put over his head. Mm-hmm. Brian De Palma
reminds me, go ahead. That crazy shot in The Untouchables, right? Which is just, so good.
I think we're all forgetting, you know, some of the great, one of the greatest Brian De Palma films of all time, Nicolas Cage's Snake Eyes, you know, which also used abundantly the point of view shot.
Isn't that also a great movie? Entirely in a point of view shot. So we're inside Nicolas Cage's point of view the entire movie.
I don't think that's correct, but it is incredible.
Maybe it just felt like that.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think that's true. I think that's true. And I don't think we shouted out the aquarium scene either, which at the time was the centerpiece of Mission Impossible 1's marketing.
Yeah, that was the big stunt that he did in that movie.
I remember that being much bigger in the 90s. And now, watching it now, it's like, that's a tiny aquarium, isn't it? It's not very big.
But I remember watching the making of features for that. And when they shot it, the whole thing takes place in, you know, 8 seconds. It's like, kaboom, water flows down, and it's like 8 seconds over. It happens so quickly. And that was one of the first experiences I had realizing what a dramatic effect slow motion had in movies compared to like how it was shot in real life. But anyway, wanted to give a shout out to that aquarium scene when he uses the gum to like detonate the glass. Super cool. Several people called me out for not mentioning Hans Zimmer's excellent score in Mission Impossible 2. Instead,
and all the cool 90s grunge rock hits.
Yeah.
Too.
Mission Impossible 2 soundtrack is a who's who
masterpiece
of things that I am now embarrassed I might have
it's
used
a masterpiece
like.
Time
like
capsule is the one you're looking for.
You got that Limp Bizkit song,
Butthole
during
Surfers,
karaoke. It was quite good.
Godsmack, Uncle Cracker, Apartment 26, Buck Cherry, Tin Fed, Powder Finger.
It's like an entire Lollapalooza lineup.
Yeah. Pretty rough. But yes, Hans Zimmer did some great work with the classical guitar in Mission Impossible 2, and wanted to give him a shout out for that because that was truly great. And finally, a couple people pointed out in Mission Impossible 3, which is Jeff Cannata's favorite film of the franchise.
I got a lot of support for that, by the way.
You did. Mission Impossible 3, we didn't mention how interesting it is that there is an entire Mission Impossible heist sequence that takes place off camera.
Yeah.
And J.J. Abrams was saying how, what if we had a heist but didn't show it at all, you know? And
that's a very Abrams move, by the way.
Yeah, he's done
that quite a bit.
Totally. And so
the scene you're referring to is when everybody is they're talking in the car, and then you just hear Tom Cruise say, go, 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 and he leaps out the window.
Yeah, that's right.
Which is so fun. It's such a fun moment of, like, we imagine all the craziness that went in there that he has to be escaping from.
Yeah, and because you've been set up to know how crazy it is from the first two films, right?
Right.
So that you can just kind of imagine for yourself what it is. But then it gets crazier after that when he base jumps off the building.
Right.
But it was a really clever move to do that. Yeah. Anyway, Christy, weren't able to get you on for last week, but did you have any favorite – do you have a favorite Mission Impossible movie or scene?
So my dirty secret is that they all blend together into just one giant movie for me as I've seen them.
Sure.
But I do remember really, really loving the Rebecca Ferguson scene where she takes her shoes off and then beats the hell out of people. Was that Go to Call? It's like those movies
Rogue
are great.
Nation.
Rebecca Ferguson, I don't remember Rebecca Ferguson beating the hell off people, beating people after taking her shoes off.
Well, the very first scene, the introductory
scene,
she takes off her shoes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was a very distinct image, especially because it came right after Jurassic World, where Bryce Dallas Howard is running around in like a spotless white outfit the whole time, and then this happened, and it felt like a commentary on that, which obviously it wasn't because it happened right after, but it just like was very sharp in my memory.
I'm actually proving your point because Paula Patton in Mission Impossible 4, Ghost Protocol, also takes her shoes off and beats the crap out of people. I'm getting it mixed up with
awesome.
That, so.
Yeah.
It's totally possible. There's just so many good things in those movies. Like, I'm so excited for the new one, in part because I'll be honest, my favorite thing that happens in the trailer for the new one is when Henry Cavill, flexes.
Yep, sorry.
That's all I'm saying.
Henry Cavill's arms. Yeah, you're spoiled, David and Jeff, for Henry
Cavill's
arms.
He has arms. I threw
my earphones out of my ears.
That's hilarious. That is all I was saying. For the people listening who are super spoiler averse, that was the end of my comment. And people who watch trailers are like, no, I know it. I know what she's talking about. I get it. It's literally... It is
Lock
a gift
load.
That I'm obsessed
Lock
with.
And
yeah,
load, Christy.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, I haven't rewatched these in a while. I probably will before I go to the screening for the next one. But yeah, I super love them. They were always so much fun. I think I had the original on VHS because I was slow to adapt.
Uh-huh.
I feel like that's accurate.
Yeah, I think that might be true of me as well. It was that like really classy, like Tom Cruise silhouette in the blue with the red lettering.
Yeah, with like steel looking. Yeah.
You guys had legal VHSs, so okay, fancy over here. Mine had like a white label, and I wrote Mission Impossible on it. That was
I had that for a lot of rated R movies that I taped off HBO while my parents were sleeping,
and they were all pan and scan.
Yeah.
That was a brutal day when I learned that was a thing and then looked at all my VHS tapes and wept and then set them on fire. No, I didn't. They're still under my bed. Who has a VCR?
I am not as hardcore about avoiding trailers as Jeff Cannata is, but I have worked so freaking hard to avoid every single trailer for Mission Impossible Fallout. Like every GIF on, if I even like in my perif, I can, if I see it in my perif on Twitter, I'm like,
a GIF in your perif?
Yeah, GIFs in my perifs. I'm just, I nope out of there, guys. I am sorry.
I know you guys are spoiler adverse, but considering that image is literally everywhere, I didn't think of it as a spoiler. That is my apology.
It's all good. But
I'm very excited. I got that invite in my email and I literally just let out like a little like, oh, like I was just like, let's do this. I'm ready. It's Mission Impossible time. I won't remember the plot 10 minutes later, and I don't care.
Did you guys see the quote? Evidently, he said he wants to keep making these until he dies.
I think that was fake news, Jeff.
Was that apocryphal?
Yeah.
I don't like using that term, David.
Have you seen the footage? This is not a spoiler, but have you seen the footage where he broke his ankle? Like, that came out like a year ago?
Yeah, that's pretty rough. Pretty rough. But yeah, I am super psyched about Mission Impossible 6 Fallout, and I am planning to see that movie no fewer than 4 times in theater, so I'm really excited about it. But
let me ask you this question, David.
Yes, ask me this question.
Do you make that – I mean, I think we all agree, we're all on the page that we expect this to be excellent.
Yes.
But – and it seems like a fairly sure thing. But do you make that plan – regardless of your first viewing
feelings? Your tickets bought already?
Yeah. That's if you came out of the first viewing of something that you intend to see 4 times in the theater, do you still follow through with viewings 2 through 4?
No, I will tell you that I have already acquired, I already have plans for my first 2 screenings. So like, I've already bought tickets for the mm-hmm. you know, I have a screening for the first one, a press screening for the first one, and I've bought tickets for the second screening already.
Oh, okay.
So,
okay.
With that said, Jeff, if I hate it, I am not going to watch it 3 and times 3 and 4. But I just don't think that's going to happen. So
fingers crossed.
I have made the plans, Jeff. Does that answer your question?
I guess.
I'm halfway into the
You will definitely be seeing it at least 2 times.
That's correct.
Yeah.
I mean, I accidentally, the greatest shame, you know, Dave Chen tries to follow through on his plans. My greatest shame is Transformers Dark of the Moon. There were multiple press screenings for that movie when I was still living in Boston. And I RSVP'd for 2 screenings because I was so confident that I was going to like that movie.
Wow.
And because I'd RSVP'd
it. Time.
Yeah, I couldn't back out of it. And that movie was like an excruciating experience.
That's amazing. You went both times?
I went both times because I didn't want to
Oh man, I would have 100% have sent an email being like, oh, I'm stuck at work, or I have leprosy.
Family emergency. Yeah. Yeah, spontaneous leprosy.
I think at the time I was kinda like I didn't want to be seen as difficult by the publicists, you know what I mean? So anyway, bad move on my part, and I deeply regret it.
I will never think of that movie the same way again. I will always think of Dave Chen sitting through it twice.
That's simply lack of creativity on your part, David. You can't come up with an excuse. You're willing to put yourself through that for lack of creativity. That's what that is.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you gotta remember, Transformers 1 was pretty good, you know, at least in my opinion. It, like, might not have been a great film, but it was
I will disagree with that strongly.
It was
ahead.
An enjoyable time at the theater.
It's watchable. Yeah.
It is completely watchable. It is
not a good sit. No.
All right. Well, anyway. Okay. So I'm planning on watching Mission Impossible Fallout a lot of times. And you know what's going to help with that, guys? Is AMC Stubbs A-List.
Explain this to me, because you asked if I was a member. Is that accurate?
Mm-hmm. I asked if you were a member, and I was stunned that Christy Puchko did not even know what it was. Which,
of all people, Christy.
Which, I mean,
I know.
Yeah.
What?
It's a shock. You know, you guys, you ever know, like, when, like, you've been following a show or, like, a sport or something, and then you talk to someone, like, this has consumed your life, and then you talk to someone, and you're like, yeah, what did you think of, like, Lord of the Rings, Return of the King? And they're like, what? I didn't know that was even out. You know, they made three of them?
Yeah.
It's like,
I like
wow.
Your example, like, took place in 1999, yeah. Or whatever that was, 2002, whatever that was.
It's like, wow, like, you just realize someone else's entire reality is different than yours. You know what I mean? Okay, so AMC Theaters recently launched a subscription service. For $20 a month, you can see three movies per week. And you can use those movies however you want. You can see three movies in a day. You can see IMAX movies.
They can all be Mission Impossible 6.
They can all be Mission Impossible 6, which is probably what mine are going to be. Yeah. And I actually released my review of AMC Stubbs A-List over at slashfilm.com. If you Google... you know, Stubbs A-List review. It's like, I think, the first two results on there. So you can check it out there. Did a video review as well. And I was grateful that AMC provided me access to it on the opening weekend. But Devendra Hardware, you are also a member of the Stubbs A-List, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And it's great.
Yeah.
I mean, I used MoviePass back in the day before it was cool, guys. Okay. I was spending...
when it was like $30, $40 a month.
Yeah. Yeah, I was spending
cool?
Well, when it was $10, it became very cool. Yeah, it's a huge hit now, Jeff. Come on.
I've gotten it for my parents as a gift, so I don't think it's cool anymore. It's like being on Facebook.
Well, there you go. That's Jump it. But, so I've used MoviePass before. I've always been frustrated with how MoviePass works because the limitations of how you get tickets. You can't reserve seats. Yeah, there are all these. You can't get to certain screenings. And by the time I was ready to leave was when, like, I was trying to go to screenings, and it just wouldn't work. For a particular showtime or something. It's just all very annoying. AMC Stubbs works for everything. I used it for a Dolby Cinema screening of Ant-Man and the Wasp this weekend. That ticket cost $23 and something in New York. I bought that one ticket and the subscription like paid for itself.
Itself and then some. You know?
And then some, and I was able to reserve that seat like a human being, like a civilized person.
Who lives in a society.
Yeah. Right? So, you know, this entire... I think the first weekend I tried to use it, there were some bugs. I tried to see Leave No Trace with it, and like it wasn't properly like buying the ticket, so I ended up just paying for that. But I think it's they've kind of ironed out the kinks, and it works flawlessly. It does what I needed to do, and luckily in New York, I think all the major chains I prefer are usually AMC theaters, so I'm totally fine with this. Probably less useful if there's no AMC near you, though.
Yeah, agree completely. I think it's a great deal. We got some flack for the show after our conversation about this a couple weeks ago. People saying we were too harsh on MoviePass. Christy, are you a MoviePass subscriber?
I'm not.
Okay. Yeah.
I use Atom, which actually doesn't have a subscription, and it's just a way to purchase movies, but they have a bunch of like BOGO deals and stuff, or like it'll be like $5 off to see this or whatever. And I don't know. I like that because it just gives me an easy way to buy movie passes.
Christy, you need to do the AMC thing just because like for what you do, like it will save your life.
No, but I get that, but I don't actually like. I don't know. I don't know that it would be worth it because there's so many movie theaters in New York. I don't know that I want to commit myself to AMC.
Right. Yeah. And you're pointing to one of the biggest downsides of AMC Stubbs A-List, which is you have to go to AMC theaters. And for a lot of people, they either don't have that many AMC theaters around them, or the AMC theaters they have near them are crappy, or they don't play the movies they want. And so I would say, you know, I live in a place. I have five AMC theaters within 30-minute drive of me. And they're very diverse, and some of them have indie films, and some of them have first-run movies. You know, like, it's very diverse. And so I'm in a good AMC situation, you know. Yeah, I have good AMC situational awareness. But if you're not that situation, I can totally understand why it's not a good option for you. And of course, it's also $20 a month instead of MoviePass is $10 a month. Yeah. I did want to just say one thing about MoviePass real quick, which is I do acknowledge it has really changed the industry. And there's a lot of people who are seeing movies today who wouldn't be seeing them if they didn't have MoviePass. You know, and on that mm-hmm. level, it's great that MoviePass has gotten more people into seeing movies. I think I'm annoyed at them because it just doesn't seem to be really particularly well run. You know, I see
kind
a lot of people.
It's a terrible business right now.
I see a lot of people complaining about it. And, you know, I've worked at companies that, you know, where I see operational excellence and see it as something to be valued. And I don't really see that with MoviePass. I see a lot of complaints about their operations. And so that's really
where. It doesn't seem like something a third party can do well.
Right.
You know, it seems like the challenges of having a third party try to do this across all theater chains seems logistically a nightmare.
Especially when one of the theater chains is like actively fighting you, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
And it's a bummer that with the AMC and whatever potential future chains jump on this bandwagon, it's a bummer that you have to lock yourself into a particular brand. But I think ultimately the end user experience is going to be much better for having that restriction because it will, you know, the theaters themselves will be still making their money through popcorn. And so they don't care, you know, they don't care so much, and it can be, you know, it can be a better experience all the way around. Whereas MoviePass doesn't have that luxury of, they don't make any money from the popcorn. So, you know,
Although
it's
want
kind
to.
Of it's basically a beta test, right? It's a beta test for how this model of cinema works. And I think it's like these theaters can look and see like, oh, $10 a month, everyone's buying it. But their business is on fire, and you know they need to get. I think they're trying to get more debt funding to even be able to stay in business. Whereas $20 seems like a more viable spot, especially for, you know, a chain like you're saying, Jeff. Like, it doesn't actually cost the theater much. And when I went to see Ant-Man this weekend, I had to buy concessions because I had nothing else to eat. So it works. The plan works, and I'm fine with it because. That Dolby screen, guys, that is the best thing. Like, that is my favorite cinema viewing experience.
Yeah,
right
I've heard the AMC Dolby is like the best experience of movies.
And those reclinable reclining seats. Fingers on mouth.
That's the thing. Like, I wish that's the one thing I wish that these apps that allow you to buy tickets. I love Adam, but I also wish Adam included this, was the information on like what the seats are like. Because like there are theater seats in New York that are hideous, and that's all I want to say about it. I don't want to dwell on it, but they're hideous. And then alternately, there's the theaters that have the beautiful leather reclining seats, and it's like, yes, those theaters cost a little more, but honestly, I will pay the extra to be in a beautiful reclining seat versus the one that I'm like, what is that stain? Why are my feet sticking to the floor?
But, Christy, lucky for you, most of those theaters in New York are AMC theaters, so sign up for this thing. It's true.
So and you get to, you know, AMC A-List treats all, it's seat agnostic, you know, so the most expensive throne like seat, you know, is cost, quote unquote, cost the same as the rattiest seat in
That's
their worst theater. So so that can be a good or bad thing depending on where you live. But I just want to say, the app is super easy to use. And it's easy to reserve seats. There's a couple of minor annoyances. I would say probably the biggest one is that the AMC week begins on Friday and ends on Thursday. So theoretically, you know, most people I know watch movies on a Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So if if the week started on a Sunday, you could watch three movies on a Saturday and three movies on a Sunday if you really want to marathon it. But the way it's structured now, you need to spread out those three movies over the weekend, if that makes sense.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Because you can watch three movies a week, which means that you could watch three on Saturday, but then you can't use it on Sunday.
Correct. Correct. So that's the biggest annoyance of A-List, I would say. But other than that, and also like no kids. So if you have like a family, you want to buy it for your kids, you can't. You'll have to use A-List for yourself and like pay for your kids' tickets, and that might be a little annoying.
A family plan for this thing will be killer.
Yeah,
it'll be
insane.
It will
destroy, you know, records in terms of how many people get this. But I think it's a great experience, and if you have AMCs near you and you see at least two movies per month. Or in the case of Devendra and your tickets are super expensive, if you see like one movie a month, it might be worth it. Now, I will say that now that I'm a member of the A-List, which, by the way, is a phrase I've said 50 times around the house, and my wife is ready to kill me.
You know when you go to concessions with the A-list, Dave, you get to go through the fast line, the A-list line.
Oh, I've seen that line.
The puny citizens.
Oh, that's actually true. Yeah. That's actually true. That reminds me. The A-list membership, which costs $20 a month, also includes the Stubbs Premiere membership.
Yes.
Yeah. Which means you can skip the line at the theater, and also I think get free popcorn and drink.
Live
upgrades.
Like kings.
No. It's not free queens. Popcorn. It's free refills on your popcorn.
Ah.
Oh, and free upgrades.
No, I think it's upgrades, Jeff. You can get
it's
larger size.
Yeah,
but that's not free popcorn, dude. That's free more.
No,
popcorn.
I said free upgrades. I didn't say free popcorn.
I thought you said free
popcorn.
Yeah. Sorry.
All this, you know, benefits that Premiere comes with, which is like $5 ticket, you know, Tuesday tickets and that kind of stuff. Like all that stuff is also included in the A-list membership. So it's another bonus there. Now, here's a problem, guys. Here's a downside of being part of the Stubbs A-list, which, as I've mentioned before, I am. And that is that once you are on the A-list, you feel the pressure to use all those credits every week. And sometimes you end up making suboptimal decisions with how those credits
are. I'm so excited where this is going.
So I thought to myself, hey, you know, after work one day, I'm going to go check out Tag, which is a movie that I would never in a million years pay money to go see. But because I'm part of the A-list,
an A-lister
A-lister, you know, I can just go see that movie for free.
I like that you've decided your time doesn't cost you anything.
It only costs you time.
My time
life.
Is meaningless. Yeah. My time is meaningless. So
the fact that we are not sponsored by AMC is just a
I know. I keep waiting for Jeff to roll in and like another thing about AMC. Yeah. Jobs. I'm like, what are we doing?
So I tweeted this out after I saw the movie. I said, quote, I went to see Tag the other day using AMC Stubbs A-list, and I thought it was really clever seeing this inconsequential trifle of a film for free. Got back to my car, and I had a $53 ticket due to a misunderstood parking sign. Most expensive single viewing of Tag ever. Fuck my life.
You're not on the municipal A-list, if you know what I mean.
Boom. Nice and done. Now, I do want to say that after seeing this, we have such amazing listeners, okay? After seeing this tweet, which got over 500 likes on Twitter, Andy S., who goes by the Twitter name X in my name, tweeted back at me, and basically he donated $53 to cover the cost of me seeing Tag, which was this ticket. So, Andy S., you're awesome. All of our listeners who support us, you're awesome. Now I feel like I have to talk about Tag, and I will talk about it just to say it was not very good.
it's a movie.
I was hoping it would be kind of like a game night, you know what I mean? Like a kind of surprise, really clever take on the concept. But for those who don't know, Tag is about this it's based on – inspired by a true story in which a bunch of friends – play tag over the course of many years. They're grown-ups. They're still playing tag every year. And I would say that it is mildly enjoyable. What's cool is like the tag scenes are done like Jeremy Renner is like the best tag player ever. And his tag scenes are done like Sherlock Holmes's action scenes, the Robert Downey Jr. ones, you know, where he's like calculating like where everyone's going, what directions, and how he can avoid getting tagged. But the movie is like fairly consequential. I think it's trying to be this kind of tribute to friendship and how the bonds of friendship can endure through the act of play over the years. And it kind of does that. It's mildly enjoyable. There's a really shoehorned in romantic subplot. But something about the image of these dudes just kind of like disregarding all social decorum and potentially like ruining other people's days by like destroying property and so on and so forth. It just rubbed me the wrong way, you know. I don't know.
So Dave, what you're saying is Tag, you're not it, right?
Yeah.
To sum up what your feelings are about that movie in
the
one
chilly
sentence.
Chilly silence is all I need from this.
Yes.
Moving on. couple other movies I saw using the A-list. Saw Sicario Day of the Soldado.
I just want to say, I think that guy got his $57 worth. I just want to say that.
Yeah, no, he's definitely high-fiving himself. Good for you, sir.
Anyway, go ahead, Dave. Sorry, go ahead. Sicario Day of the Soldado.
Sicario Day of the Soldado, one of the worst movie titles ever. The sequel to Sicario, It turns out when you take Sicario, which is widely regarded as a great film, and you remove an amazing director in Denis Villeneuve, great actor Emily Blunt, and legendary cinematographer Roger Deakins, you have not that much left. You have a the action is really well done. It's very tense and it's very thrilling. But politically, this movie is a mess. I mean,
is it cynical, Dave? Is it nihilistic? That's all I think some people watch.
It's nihilistic, but like not in the right way. I mean, I'll put it this way: like the opening credits or the opening text posits that like the most valuable thing that Mexican cartels are trafficking is not drugs; it's people across the border, and some of these people are Islamic extremist terrorists. So it's like finding two ways for the American people to be scared of brown people.
And that is like a double. That is like a Big Mac of racism. Jingoistic fear.
Xenophobia. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that that would be potentially okay if the movie had something interesting to say about that. About American xenophobia and American foreign policy.
But it turns out we are all the so. Soldados.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I mean,
the soldado was us all the time. Yeah.
That's right. I mean, the movie has nothing interesting to say, and the final third goes off the rails in really crazy and insane ways that makes it bear absolutely no resemblance to the first film. So I would say see Sicario Day of the Soldado for the action, but do not go in expecting like smart commentary on American politics. And finally, had a chance to see the first Purge. Which, true story, I go to see the first Purge, and there's not that many people in the theater. A mother walks into the theater shortly before it begins with three toddlers, all of them under 5 years old, and just, plops them down. Like she's sitting in the handicap section where there's, space for wheelchairs and stuff, but instead of a wheelchair, there's a stroller there with two kids that are, tiny. The kids can't be more than, 3 years old. Mm-hmm. And then proceeds to watch the first Purge in which many, many people are brutally slaughtered in graphic fashion.
But did the kids enjoy it?
most of them, some of them were playing around on tablets the entire time.
We deserve to be purged.
Yeah. Anyway, the first Purge, it's a prequel. It shows you what the first Purge was like. I'm just going to say, I don't know why I continue watching these movies. I've seen every single Purge movie.
The A-list, baby!
Yeah, A-list. I mean, it's kind of like the Saw movies. I have this kind of sick fascination with them. And I'm going to watch them no matter what. But
you've seen every Saw movie, Dave, and I still don't understand
I've seen
why.
Every Saw movie. I've seen every Purge movie.
Yeah.
They're not good. They're not good movies.
I'm sitting over here saying, what are you...
But I'm totally okay tapping out of a franchise that I'm just like, no, this is not for me. Yeah, I didn't see this one just because I didn't. I like the movie's fine, but I don't know. I haven't. Yeah, I think it's just that it doesn't feel escapist fun for me anymore.
No. It's about the U.S. government trying to inflict horrors upon people of color, basically. And but the people of color striking back in very brutal and effective fashion. And I just want to give a shout out to Elon Noel, who is one of the main actors in this film. I think this guy's going places. He acquits himself very well. I think he could be an action star going forward. So I just want to give a shout out to him. Okay. So that is my week with AMC Stubbs A-List. Three pretty mediocre films. And so far, I don't know if I'm getting value.
This started off as a great pitch for AMC Stubbs A-List. Yeah. And then quickly became like, so...
Yeah. A-List. You'll see so much more crap. Right.
You know, Dave, you don't have to use all your A-List tickets. You could just let it go, man.
Yeah.
Just let it go.
Now, that being said, I did want to use my A-List tickets on a screening of Leave No Trace, which I didn't have a chance to do because the theater was a little too far away from me. But Christy Puchko, I think this is a movie that you've seen this week, right?
It is. So Leave No Trace is from Deborah Granik, who did Winter's Tale, which everybody kind of knows.
I believe.
Yes, yeah, sorry. I just really love Winter's Tale. That's not a joke.
Very good, yes.
Yeah, also great. They're very different films. But Winter's Bone, the one that Jennifer Lawrence was the breakout star of, and then actually what's crazy is that movie was hugely praised. It made John Hawks a big name again. And not again, but period. People were John Hawks, John Hawks. And brought him into the spotlight. And Deborah Granik could not get another movie made after that. Super weird. So she made like a documentary that was actually pretty good. But finally, someone got her backing and she made Leave No Trace, which is based on a novel. But it stars Ben Foster and a New Zealand actress named Thomasin McKenzie. And it's basically, it starts off where it looks like you're watching a father and daughter camping in the woods, but you quickly realize through kind of their comfort there and the way they're situated that they're not camping, that this is where they live and how they live. And it's a really beautiful story about a father-daughter relationship where I don't want to get too much into what his deal is, but essentially, like, he chooses to live off the grid and she's kind of brought along with that because she's his daughter. And when that way of life is disrupted, how their relationship transforms. And it is beautiful filmmaking. It's so intimate that you feel like you're watching, you know, real life unfold. And this girl is so young, but she's so just there in front of the camera. She's so, I hate the word authentic when you talk about acting, because I feel like that word feels wrong, but she's so natural in front of it. And she seems in times like a 14-year-old girl and in times like a 30-year-old woman. Like, she just has this composure that your heart breaks for her and your heart breaks for him. Like, Ben Foster is great. Like, he's been great for a very long time, but this is really like her movie and her performance. And it's a very quiet and kind of slow movie. So, you know, you kind of have to be in the mental space for that, but it's astonishing. I do think it offers some of the best performances this year. And it's just a very striking movie that relies deeply on visuals and deeply on the performances of actors. There's not a lot, because these people like know each other so well, it's not a lot of talking. There's no big Oscar like baiting kind of scenes that you would see play, you know, like no one's like, let me tell you why I'm upset and I live in the woods. Like, there's nothing like that. It really trusts the audience. Deborah Granik really trusts the audience to exist in this life with them and understand who they are without feeling the need to like give us intense expositional dialogue about where they're at. And it was just very striking. Like I had heard praise about it, I think, coming out of as early as Sundance. And I was excited to see it because I loved Winter's Bone. And it's just beautiful. Like, it's just, it makes me really frustrated that it took her so long to be able to make another movie. But she's talked about how hard it is to get funding. And I'm hoping that it won't be so difficult now, because this movie is getting wild praise and it totally deserves it.
The moral of the story is, use your A-list slots on Leave No Trace, everyone. That is really what you got to do in this case, so that Deborah Granik can make her next film even more quickly. So that's Leave No Trace. It's out in theaters right now. Davinder, you saw it too, right?
I saw it. It's fantastic. I just want to say it is a very like natural spiritual successor to Winter's Bone 2, I think. Like, it is about people living on the edges of society in a way, and it gives you a glimpse of, like, you know, portions of the population that you may not normally get to see, especially featured in movies. The performances are fantastic, but for me, like, what really struck me about this movie is that, you know, it is filled with these quiet moments that seem like meaningful and interesting, you know, when you watch them, and then the next day you remember that thing and like, man, that is absolutely heartbreaking. Like, this one moment of like, there's a point where you see some, you know, teen girls talking about making collages to remember to dream.
Yeah, because, vision boards.
Yeah, vision boards, because like it's so easy in their lives not to be able to do that, not to see a future for themselves. And that's it. You never see those people again. And yet that idea lingers on, I think, carries out throughout the movie. And this movie is just full of things like that. So fantastic. And I think Thomasin McKenzie definitely, I think, evokes the same feelings I had watching Jennifer Lawrence in Winter's Bone. Like, there is this both, there's strength and vulnerability there in this character, and also just like a real, you know, a real person. And it's, yeah, just fantastic.
All right, Christy, you've also been watching Glow Season 2, right, on Netflix?
I have. And I wanted just a quick shout out to people who follow me on Twitter. I know I put up a poll because I was like, hey, I haven't been on in a couple of weeks. What should I talk about, what we were watching? And yes, sorry to bother you, 100% won the poll. We're going to talk about it eventually. So I'm going to hold off on talking about it today. Thank you all for voting. If you can't wait to hear my opinion on it, I'm quoted in the trailer, so you can look up my review.
I saw the trailer for Sorry to Bother You, and I was really excited that I have podcasted with two people who have been quoted in the trailer for that film. Christy Puchko, and I think Ben Pearson was also quoted in the trailer as well. So, yeah, sorry to bother you. Definitely a movie we will be reviewing. I actually tried to see it this last week, again, using A-List, but it was not playing at my local AMC.
The Purge was just too compelling.
It was not playing at Devendra, okay? All right. Christy.
So I just wanted to give that a shout out before people come at me and are like, that didn't even win the poll. But yeah, I also marathoned Glow season 2 because I really liked Glow season 1. I was very excited when it hit Netflix. And it's so good. I was worried after Glow season 1 that I was like, that was amazing. But how do you keep telling the story and growing these characters? And, you know, like, where do you go from here? And they have found such interesting places to go. It's just... I'm fascinated by every episode, and every episode gives these characters like a richer idea, like us a richer idea who they are. And I am a little disappointed that I feel like the characters of color still get kind of a raw deal this season, where like everybody's talking about episode 4, one of the characters gets a little more attention, which is great. But it also feels like they're still kind of being like kicked to the curb a little bit with like occasionally they get a plot line.
This is the rare Netflix show that needs more episodes.
It's just funny.
Yeah.
But I think it has really good storytelling. There's some really fascinating things that happen this season, and it's still so funny in this like weirdly like acerbic but tender way, where you're watching these people break and rebuild themselves in ways both metaphorical and sometimes literal. And I think it's just outstanding. And like Betty Gilpin is so good that it's insane to me that we haven't been talking about her for years. Like it just feels like she feels like such a discovery, which feels crazy. And Alison Brie. It's like I'm so used to seeing Alison Brie being this like just absolute bombshell in movies, and often in movies that don't know what to do with her. So she's just like Will Ferrell's wife for a minute or whatever. And in this, it's like
that was,
you know,
a great audio representation of what Will Ferrell's wife is in movies. Just wanted to
thank you.
That out.
Yeah. Thank you. I've been working on that.
Will Ferrell's wife in the movie. Yeah. Anyway. Good.
But yeah, she gets to really do some interesting things in this, where she plays a character who like. You like Ruth despite the fact that Ruth is kind of terrible. And I like the fact that it doesn't feel bad about making you like giving you characters that are like awful, but also compelling, but also passionate and compassionate. And I just had such a good time watching the show. And I think episode 9 is one of the best episodes that Netflix has produced of any of their shows. I will just say that and leave it at that, because I'm trying really hard not to give spoilers. But yeah, it's really, really fun. I recommend, if you like the first season, check it out. I think if you've never watched Glow, 100% still check it out. I don't care about wrestling. Sorry, Jeff. But this to me is like Friday Night Lights, where I don't care about football, but like, oh man, I could watch them play forever.
Because like, it's about the drama behind like the sport, right? Which is totally fine. Like I certainly wouldn't care as much about like a behind the scenes of the WWF before it became the WWE and everything. Whereas this like is so compelling. The one thing I'd say, like, I don't know. I love everything about the show. I do feel like Marc Maron's character, they do some odd things with him this season. Like he starts off almost like completely reverting from whatever progress he made in season 1. And it's like, we got to build up that character to not be a huge asshole all the time. So there is some of that.
It does feel like they regress a little bit for reasons that are a little squiffy.
Yeah. But beyond that, like, it is fantastic. Everyone should be watching this.
Cool. Well, that's Glow season 2. And it's available right now on Netflix. Speaking of Netflix, Chef Kanata, you also saw something on Netflix this week, right?
I did. I watched the stand-up special Nanette, which is getting a lot of buzz recently. And it is a stand-up special by Hannah Gadsby, who is an Australian stand-up who I was not familiar with, actually, before seeing this, but evidently has had a long and illustrious career down under.
Wow.
This is
Night first of a Thousand Impressions. Jeff and I got.
We're doing this. We're doing
it. I hear all of Australia like sending complaints right now.
My only Australian impression is saying the word no, because Australians say the word no like it has 15 syllables, which is so great. They say nay.
This is a really great introduction.
You can send your letters to Jeff Cannata.
At Jeff Cannata, 2N1T on Twitter. This is a really great way to introduce the lighthearted romp Nanette on Netflix.
I was blown away by Nanette. I, like I said, I jumped in not knowing anything about it. Started up fan of stand-up comedy, and I consider myself kind of a student of stand-up comedy. And this is a brilliant piece that sort of transcends the medium and actually kind of deconstructs the concept of stand-up comedy, and it uses it as a way of being a piece that is more about activism than anything else and more about speaking truth to power. And it does so in a very powerful way. I mean, I know comedy can speak truth to power at its best in a very potent way. But I think in this special, Hannah Gadsby figures out ways to kind of poke holes in how comedy does that and analyze herself and her own career in ways that I found to be really beautiful and inspiring to me. I was moved by the end of it. It is, I think, an extraordinary work of art, and it's more a performance art piece, I think, than a stand-up comedy special. It's quite something, and I think everybody should watch it. I tweeted this, and I will repeat it here. I find it really sad to note that I think the people who would most benefit from watching this will never see it. But I urge everyone out there to not let that be you. Like, I think you should take the time. It's an hour special. I think you'll get something out of it, and I think you will probably be moved as I was by Nanette on Netflix.
Devendra, you also saw this, right?
I saw it too, and it's tremendous. Everything you're saying is true, Jeff. It feels more like a confessional than a traditional, you know, stand-up routine. The story behind this is that this whole, you know, act was her kind of farewell to comedy, and it ended up being very successful, like when she was doing it live, and it helped her actually, you know, stick around. And I'm glad, because it shows, like, you could tell, like, she is really wearing her heart on her sleeve in this thing. Like, it goes places you don't expect. I don't want to reveal too much, but you know, it's not all laughs, and I think it's really smart about how it does that, and it's so real and raw and true. I wouldn't call it a standard, you know, a traditional comedy special, but it is still worth watching for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I thought of it watching it, like, it does, calling it a deconstructed comedy set is really interesting. I was thinking of it more like a storytelling set, especially there's one segment where she talks about kind of the difference between jokes and stories, and I thought that was a really interesting discussion. And it was a lot of things where I kept kind of nodding, which reminded me of this, like, Chris Rock joke where he said that if the audience is, like, nodding and cheering, it's not actually comedy. And I don't know that I agree with that, but it's something that, like, was sticking in my head watching it. And Nanette was fascinating, because, like, I was laughing and then I was captivated and then I cried at one point and I felt very moved, and it left me a lot to chew on. And in that respect, it actually reminded me, and I don't know if you guys have seen this, but HBO did a special with Chris Gethard called Career Suicide, I think last year. Do you know that one?
I haven't heard of it, but big Chris Gethard fan here.
It's really, like, it's also a confessional story that, like, takes us through a lot of things and like, how comedy helps and heals, and how it also deals with issues of kind of inspiration and about whether or not an artist needs to suffer to create art. And it reminded me a lot of those things. And when watching his, I was really struck, because I had never quite seen anybody do comedy that way before, and they're not similar in their, like, takes necessarily, but I think they're doing similar things where they are going to a very deep place of things that I think a lot of people are afraid to talk about or even look directly at.
I'm the only one that remembers the Beatles.
Hello, I'm Guy Garvey. Richard Curtis and Danny Boyle have joined forces for Yesterday. We got them together to talk filmmaking.
I always saw Trainspotting just as the Northern Four Weddings.
Music.
These songs were part of us.
And a world without the Beatles.
A world without the Beatles would be infinitely worse.
The Yesterday podcast, available from wherever you get your podcasts. Yesterday.
When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
And to bring them to the light and say, okay, so let us shine a light on this. Let us look into the darkness. Let us laugh and also let us move past that and see what we can learn from this. And it's really bold. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it's kind of jarring because it's like I finished watching it and then Netflix was like, and now we recommend. I was like, no. Like, I need time. I can't.
Let's sit with this. Yeah.
Right. Like, just throw me into like, and now, you know, here's a man with puppets. Like, I can't. I don't remember what it was trying to offer me. I shut off my TV because I just needed to kind of sit for a little bit.
Can I point out something? This is very tangential, but it reminded me. I've also been watching the new season of Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee. And there's one of the early episodes of the new season of that show, someone mentions the fact that Netflix has recently shortened the time it takes to start the next thing, the next episode of a thing, yep. to like 5 seconds. And it's extraordinary what effect that has had on me. I will watch way more things. And it's kind of frightening.
They know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Nanette, it's on Netflix. It's very provocative. It's very bold. It's worth checking out. And you should do so. All right. Devendra, you have a few things to mention, right?
Yeah, a couple of things. And I'll just move along real quickly. I saw the pilot episode for Pose, the next Ryan Murphy show. It's another Ryan Murphy show, guys. Like so many.
That's the 18th this year?
It's many. It like is certainly many. Yeah, and among the dozens of his entire career, yeah. But this is a show set in the 1980s in New York, and it covers ball culture, which is you know, kind of a unique thing in the LGBT community, where people just kind of, you know, will dress up and strut or dance or just do something to really show off in a group setting. And it's entirely about that. This is a show that I think it goes some really interesting places. It starts off, it kind of really shows you how this whole community works, because it's a weird thing if you've never heard of it. It's made up of these houses, and it's groups of people who kind of band together, and they're sort of like teams, and every week they go and strut as a team. And I don't know, the show I think is just really fantastic in the way it approaches all this material. The soundtrack is amazing. I love all of the characters, and it covers a lot of territory that you think would seem like old hat right now, right? One of the earliest things that happens is a young boy who's a dancer and who's gay ends up coming out to his family, and they banish him from the house, and he ends up on the streets in New York. And I don't want it to sound too flippant about it, but it does seem like a story that we hear sometimes quite a bit. And this show just treats that in such a new and unique way. Like it really takes a lot of these tropes that we've seen, I think just reinvigorates them. And there's a lot going on here too, because it's also about, in addition to ball culture, it's also like the introduction of the super rich society in New York. Like Donald Trump is a character off screen the show. James Vanderbeek plays a character who's kind of an upper crusty management type, who's like, you know, he's one of those people who's always chasing money and doing coke in the middle of meetings, and really representing like Donald Trump culture. And to see that idea with like the LGBT community kind of like juxtaposed right next to each other is really daring and interesting. There are several dance sequences in this show that are fantastic. There's one set to a Whitney Houston song. Name is escaping me right now.
So Emotional?
No, it was one about dancing.
Want to Dance with Somebody?
Want to Dance with Somebody, of course. It is Want to Dance with Somebody. And it's done, it's shot in such a like dynamic way. Just like a lot of times when you see dancing sequences in movies and TV, it's too close. The shots aren't correct. Like, you're not seeing what's actually happening. It's so dynamic. The show is incredibly uplifting in a way, too, because it is about the start of a new house that's going to be posing during the weekly show. And I don't know. I just found it really compelling to see, like, all these people come together, kind of form a makeshift family to support each other in a really difficult time. It is perfect summer viewing. Like, if you want, like, a summer show that's just going to make you, like, stand up and clap and cheer, this feels like it. And shocking that it's from yet another Ryan Murphy show, too, because it feels like this guy is just pumping out TV shows. Some of them work, some of them don't. This one definitely works.
Cool. That's Pose, and it's on FX right now. Anything else you've been watching, Devendra?
A couple of things. I did see the first episode of Sharp Objects as well. And this is the new HBO series directed by Jean-Marc Vallée. And based on the novel by Gillian Flynn, it's also adapted for TV by Marty Noxon, who she used to work on Buffy and a whole bunch of other TV shows.
Unreal was her most recent.
Yeah, Unreal too. Yeah, like she has a huge pedigree. And just like this combination of talent, this show, guys, is so good. Like it is such a like deep drink of like Southern Gothic. Like it is slow. It is hot. Everyone is sweating all the time. Amy Adams plays a woman who goes back to her small hometown to investigate a murder. And there's also a lot of like bad things that happen to her in that town, too. And, you know, it's kind of her dealing with her own childhood trauma there while investigating this really like grisly thing happening. She's actually investigating a kidnapping of a girl. But in that same town, a girl was found murdered recently. So the worry is that it's a serial killer. There's so much going on. And I kind of love the way Jean-Marc Vallée does his style, right? The thing we saw in, Big Little Lies. Yeah. The way he combines visuals and music, I think is really interesting. Like you just remember the opening song of Big Little Lies, right? And that title sequence, like that is really evocative. And he does that here too. There's a lot of Led Zeppelin. There's a lot of like driving alone in the road at night. And it just like portrays such a mood. Amy Adams is fantastic. Patricia Clarkson plays her very distant mother. Chris Messina is in this, who I love. And Chris Messina as sort of like this Southern detective as well, who kind of sparks with Amy Adams, of course. This is like a reunion of that was a rom-com, wasn't it, with those two? It feels reminiscent of something, but it's just nice to see all these folks together. And Amy Adams is like giving us one of her like arrival level of performances, just like fantastic here. So, yeah, watch it, all of you. This is another. It's like two very different summer shows, right? If you want to feel energized and pumped up, watch Pose. If you want to just like sit with a glass of whiskey and really like drink in. Kind of like the darker side of summer in the, you know, Southern Gothic style. This is a really good thing to check out.
All right, that's Sharp Objects, and it's on HBO.
Yeah.
It's such a good sale now. I want to watch it immediately, even though before the record I told Devendra, I'm going to wait until the end, and then I can just binge
Christy,
it all.
You want to, and also this is a show I feel like, even if you've read the novel, I do feel, from what I've heard, it actually improves on the book in many ways, and it's just, I love following along with these shows with people, right? Like, True Detective Season 1, so much of the joy, and like the way a lot of folks watch Westworld now, right, Dave? Part of the joy is following along and seeing, like, you know, what's happening every episode, so, yeah, there's that.
Yeah.
I was late to Killing Eve. I have mixed feelings on this, because sometimes it's awesome, and sometimes I just want everyone to shut up so I can like the thing I'm watching.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
And,
yep, go ahead, Devendra.
Also, so that's fantastic. Just go watch that. And also Cell Blockers, which you guys recently talked about. And I love that movie. That movie is fantastic. That movie worked better for me than Game Night, honestly, because I think the emotional core of Blockers definitely hits to where I am right now. That's entirely a movie about, you know, parent and daughter relationships. And it is so sweet and so effective. Like, yeah, it does a lot of new things that I'm really surprised by. So love Blockers.
Before we move on to our review of Ant-Man and the Wasp today, we also want to thank all the people that donated to the /Homecast. Again, a big shout out to Andy S., who hooked me up with some parking ticket money, and also to Evan Lambert and Jasmine Levy, both of whom became subscribers at the rate of $2 per month. Big thanks to everyone who donates to the /Homecast. All the money you donate does go to help us defray the cost of seeing movies and putting on the show. If you want to donate,
I'd just like to say that Devendra and Christy and I also get parking tickets.
It's true.
Yeah. No, that's a good thing to tell people about. To donate to us, you can go to paypal.me/filmcast. That's paypal.me/filmcast. You can also go to /film.com. Click on the /filmcast tab and use the PayPal links on the side of the page. You guys are awesome. Thanks for your donations. Let's get to our review of Ant-Man and the Wasp.
I just have one question. When Cap needed help, if I'd asked you, would you have come?
I guess we'll never know. But if you had, you'd have never been caught.
I do some dumb things, and the people I love the most, they pay the price.
Thanks to you, we had to run. We're still running.
Let's go.
That was from the trailer for Ant-Man and the Wasp. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. As Scott Lang balances being both a superhero and a father, Hope Van Dyne and Dr. Hank Pym present an urgent new mission that finds the Ant-Man fighting alongside the Wasp to uncover secrets from their past. So, Christy Puchko, I remember when we did our Summer Movie Wager Part 1, you said that Avengers Infinity War was going to make Ant-Man and the Wasp look like Kitty Time Frolics in comparison. Because of how high-stakes Avengers was going to be compared to Ant-Man and the Wasp, which is like seemingly small stakes by comparison, literally. And so questions for you. Number one, did your prediction turn out to be correct? And number two, is that a bad thing if it is correct?
I'm going to say it is correct. Because literally there's action sequences that are basically them turning San Francisco into a playground. But I think that's actually awesome. When I made that statement, I don't think we had seen Infinity. Maybe I had. I don't know. I did not know how much I would need Ant-Man and the Wasp in my life.
Yeah.
It's so much fun. Like, I liked the first movie fine, but like I didn't, you know, ever feel the need to really watch it again. I did before I saw this one just because I was writing some stuff and I wanted to be like, make sure I understood stuff again. And like the stuff where like he's little, I always liked, but then there was a lot of things in the first movie I didn't feel worked as well, which we can get more into as spoilers, but I had no problems enjoying the hell out of the second one. It's just so fun and it's so imaginative and they take the things that didn't work in the first one and figure out ways to make them work in the second. I just had an absolute blast. And they put Michelle Pfeiffer in this one, which, like, I did not care about this movie until I saw Michelle Pfeiffer was in it. And then I was like, oh, come on. Like, that felt like Marvel was reaching out and being like, go ahead, Puchko, try something. You're going to not watch this movie? Because for those that don't know, one, I am obsessed with Michelle Pfeiffer. Two, her performance of Catwoman in Batman Returns is the greatest performance in a superhero movie. Come at me. I don't, like, you're wrong.
Agree. Hard agree. Yes.
So yeah, my only complaint about this movie really is that there's not enough Michelle Pfeiffer. But as I said on Twitter, that is true in most movies.
Jeffrey Cannata, I have heard tell that you are a zombie of the Marvel type. I've heard that you might be into these Marvel films.
Indeed.
Vague whispers through the ether have heard of this. Yeah.
Yeah. In what bizarre, crazy future am I talking about the second Ant-Man movie?
Okay, I mean, Jeff, I'm going to blow your mind even more, okay? Which is, we are living in a universe. Like, imagine telling this to yourself, you know, 10 years ago. Hey, 10 years from now, there's going to be a sequel to an Ant-Man movie and a Star Wars film based on Han Solo's life. Yeah. And one of them is going to do better than the other, and also have much more critical acclaim than the other.
One of them I'm going to love, and the other one I'm going to find very disappointing.
I don't think it's going to outgrow Solo, but it's going to come really close, and that is insane. Yeah,
massive ramifications for the wager. By the way, we can't even get into that. It's a topsy turvy, cats and dogs living together.
Totally.
Yes, I echo everything that Christy said. It is delightful. It is this sort of wonderful counterpoint to the you know, bleak, dark Avengers Infinity War, the very serious, self-serious movie that is. This is just having so much fun, but not at the expense of your brain cells. You know, it doesn't insult your intelligence at any point. It's very funny. It's very charming. I mean, Paul Rudd is so charming. I think the big coup in this movie is how wonderful and watchable and exciting and thrilling Evangeline Lilly is. Mm-hmm. She is she's the star. I mean, it's Ant-Man and the Wasp, but this is like a Wasp action movie with this funny Ant-Man sidekick. You know, it is really from the word go. It's about how badass the Wasp is, and she's fantastic in it. I definitely agree there should be more Michelle Pfeiffer, but I also agree that, man, the making people young technology, we've basically perfected that.
It's oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I love how inventive and clever the all the miniaturization stuff is in this universe. It's like somebody sat around and just like brainstormed all the most wonderful ways you could use shrinking and growing technology. Mm-hmm. And I love also that we had an entire movie where they limited themselves to just doing tiny stuff. And then, spoilers for Captain America Civil War, but then in Civil War, we got that great moment where, oh, we can do big. And now in this movie, we get to do tiny and big. And it is so fun and so inventive. And Michael Peña is delightful. I mean, it is as, I think, sure thing entertainment, like mass market entertainment that feels good when you walk in, feels good when you walk out. As you can get. I can recommend it to anybody. It is dang fun.
Your thoughts, Steven, your hard or?
Yeah, I think fun is the key word here. I was not expecting much from this movie. I enjoyed the first one, but I don't really have any particular love for this character. But yeah, the combination of Paul Rudd and Evangeline Lilly, like actually being an active participant, you know, now in the movie and also kicking ass, like I think they've stepped up. The set pieces, the action is fantastic. And also, we haven't mentioned Hannah John Kamen yet, who I love in this movie. Like, she plays the villain, Ghost, who I think has a very sympathetic background, similar to Killmonger and Black Panther. Certainly not as complex as that character, but there's a lot going on there. And, they hinted at this in the trailers, but there is some sort of like phasing technology going on with her. So between that, you have the miniaturization, you have the growth stuff, and then you have this phasing character who reminds me of like the twins from The Matrix Reloaded, except done well. Like, I think the set pieces where they have her in it kicking butt are really well done. So I enjoyed the energy of this character and also the actress as well. I think Hannah John Kamen really gives us something more, because the character isn't super well written. There's not much there, but I think she really adds a lot to this character. And also very nice to have Lawrence Fishburne in the Marvel Universe now. So, yeah, really enjoyed it overall.
This movie was fun. It was, you know, an enjoyable time at the theater. One of the better Marvel sequels, I would say. You know, I would put this well above Thor the Dark World, not as good as Captain America Winter Soldier, better than Iron Man 2. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of one of the better sequels. I think the filmmaker, Peyton Reed, has a lot of confidence. You know, like when Ant-Man first came out, I think it's easy to forget how insane it was that like all the stuff that went into that movie coming out. First of all, right. There's obviously Edgar Wright had been working on it for many, many years. But in addition, the idea of a character named Ant-Man was deemed by many to be ludicrous at the time. And now, of course, we know Marvel can basically sell anything, so Ant-Man and the Wasp is going to be very enjoyable regardless. Like, you kind of know what you're getting. It's a known quantity. It's a lot of fun. I thought it was solid mid-tier Marvel. I didn't think it was particularly great. I think it's trying to do a lot of things, surprisingly, for an Ant-Man movie. Like, there's a lot of characters, a lot of plot developments introduced in this one that make it a little bit too busy. And the movie kind of had this feeling of video gamey fetch quests to me. Like, oh, we have to get the thing, but then, oh my gosh, like, something is impeding us from getting the thing, so now we got to solve this problem, and then we got to get the thing, and then use the thing to make the other thing. You know, I know I'm describing basically every Marvel film, but for this one, it felt particularly acute.
Right, and the first movie was very much a heist movie, too, so I did feel like that was a part of it. Yeah,
exactly. The first movie felt like it moved a little bit more in a way that kind of felt like more of a satisfying payoff. But the first movie also had disadvantages, which is to say, like a pretty crappy villain. I agree with you that Hannah John Kamen's character here, she plays, what is the character that she plays
Ghost.
In this movie?
Ghost right. slash Ava.
Yeah, that's a lot more, both in conception and execution, just really well done. And just like the effect is super cool, and really like her. So Yeah, I thought it was fun. There's some more to talk about in spoilers because we got to talk about how this ties into the broader Marvel universe.
Well, my biggest complaint actually is honestly some of the pseudoscience is just a little fast and loose. I mean, it's a comic book movie, obviously, but I think this one is a little bit more cartoonish with just how they explain some of the concepts.
We get to like magical power type stuff eventually. Yeah. I will say though, like, we haven't even mentioned Walton Goggins in this movie yet.
I know, he's great.
I don't know about that.
I love Goggins.
We will fight about this as spoilers.
Yeah. I love Goggins so much, but I actually think the movie would have been stronger if we cut everything around him and whatever the hell his henchmen were doing out completely.
Yeah, I agree. I just think the movie's trying to do too much. You know, it introduces all these characters, and it's just I agree with you, Devendra. I think there's a little too much there with Goggins, and that not a particularly memorable character in my opinion.
They're so useless. They're even though Goggins is great, gangsters like so useless. I don't know.
All right, a couple other things I want to mention actually before we get to spoilers. One is, you know, Jeff Cannata always likes to go in unsullied into movies, and I gotta admit, I usually like to as well, but I let myself lapse for this one. I thought to myself, you know what, it doesn't matter if I see the trailer for Ant-Man and the Wasp. Big mistake, because virtually every single major action beat of the film is given away in the trailer. So, kind of disappointing. If you haven't seen the trailer, I would avoid it before you go see Ant-Man and the Wasp.
I got lots of people on Twitter agreeing with you, Dave. I got lots of people like, why didn't I listen to you?
Yeah, I know. It's particularly acute in this one. Randall Park is awesome, as usual.
He's
great.
In this movie. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
He should be in all the Marvel films and really like
him. Agreed.
And,
I'm 1 degree of separation away from this movie, guys. I've worked with Randall Park.
In what, Jeff?
It is a web series, but it was a good web series.
Why don't you shout it? I'm basically trying to tell you to tell people how to find it, Jeff.
I don't know how to find it at this point.
I mean, tell people how to Google it, for Pete's sake.
I'd have to
You don't
look.
Even know the name. You don't even know the name of the web series.
Don't remember the name. It's so embarrassing.
I was like, why is Jeff not promoting this right now? Anyway, okay.
What is it called?
How to Get Ahead in Hollywood, the Jeff Cannata story. Yeah.
And finally,
and people wonder why I'm not successful.
I wanted to also, you know, Jeff talked about the de-aging technology, and you do see some of these characters in younger form than you do in the movie. Like, you see them in both young and old forms. Jeff, I remember when we reviewed Guardians of the Galaxy 2, you were like, this is the movie that proves that, you know, de-aging has been mastered. And I did not agree with you at the time. I thought they did a good job.
It was the Russell Crowe.
Kurt Russell, I think is what you mean.
Oh, excuse me, Russell Crowe. Yeah.
It took me a second. I was like, wait, who's Russell Crowe?
See, I don't remember anything. I have two children under 2 years old, guys. My brain doesn't work.
Yeah. Every day is a million hours anymore. I totally get it.
Yeah.
Anyway, yes, Kurt Russell. The de-aging at the beginning of that movie. I just thought that was fantastic. But now, I mean, this is
like beyond.
Here's
this is beyond.
Thing, though,
like,
I will say this. I feel like Michelle Pfeiffer, they just put like a slightly bright light on her because she is still flawless. Like, we need to make her look older. We'll give her like a granny wig, but she is still amazing looking. But I do agree with you on the rest.
Do you guys think that it's easier or harder for them to do it with actors that we know of at that age?
I'm like, sure it's
we've
easier.
Seen it now we've seen it now with Robert Downey Jr., with Kurt Russell, and with Michelle Pfeiffer,
didn't they do it for Johnny Depp in one of the Pirates movies too?
Yeah. Oh, that was terrible.
That was real bad. Yeah. He looked nothing like him. That was weird. I think it's not just that we know what they look like before, but also, like, I think it's tougher with men, because with women, you're trying to make them look the way we make women look in movies, where it's like they've never had a pore their entire life, so they can be really smooth. But men, it's like you need to get like the structure of their face a little more specific.
Michael Douglas's face is very interesting, and it's really hard to just like reshape that into being young. Yeah,
and he straight up still has old dude body.
Yeah.
I remember the first time like this technology was discussed on this podcast. I think it was Russ Fisher was here on the podcast. We were talking about X-Men Origins Wolverine, and he said Patrick Stewart comes out at the end looking like he came out of the Polar Express is what he said.
And they did it in X3 as well. Like, that was, I think, one of the first big sequences.
One of those movies. And like, how we have come a long way. Like, Patrick Stewart did look terrible in that film. And now it is photorealistic, in my opinion. And
sure. And my point that I was trying to make there was like it. They also have way more reference points for these actors that actually you can go back and say, oh, this is how she looked in as Catwoman or, you know, in myriad other movies, you know, Fabulous Baker Boys, for Christ's sake.
Right.
You can go, thank you. And you can actually go, oh, that's actually how they looked on camera at that age. And I wonder if you have an actor for whom you don't have that copious amount of reference material, if it's more difficult or – I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out.
We'll see. Maybe we'll have an A-B comparison at some point. But this also has implications for the Captain Marvel film that's coming out next year, because the Captain Marvel film is theoretically, I'm going to tell you when Captain Marvel takes place. Mm-hmm. So if you don't want to know when that takes place, don't listen to the next few sentences.
I also think we will certainly dive more into this in spoilers too, yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. We can wait till spoilers. I'm cool with that. So I guess... wait for a few seconds for spoilers for me to talk more about, for me to finish the sentence I was going to say. So, spoilers for Ant-Man and the Wasp starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
Can I see this coming?
No.
But you won't find it because, of course...
you're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret.
You want to be fooled.
All right, so we're going to spoil not just Ant-Man and the Wasp, but every Marvel film up to this point. So just FYI.
If you haven't seen the Captain Marvel script.
That's right. Movies not yet to be released.
Yeah. So theoretically, Captain Marvel was going to take place in the 90s, and it was going to show a pre-one eye getting damaged Nick Fury. And
a two-eyed Nick Fury.
That's right. I had just assumed that they would hire a younger actor for Samuel L. Jackson's character, but having seen Ant-Man and the Wasp, I am now.
No need.
They don't need to do that anymore. I feel like they could
Films now with just young Michelle Pfeiffer. Why not young Kurt Russell?
Yeah, it's the Congress. That's right.
It's all the Congress.
Congress, and then be terrified.
The Congress is so good. We've seen this tech used in like a couple of minutes worth of scenes. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What would it be like to do it for the entire movie? That would certainly be a milestone. So
I agree.
It would be expensive, but yeah. I feel like we're quickly getting there.
Oh, it's a couple of years away at most, and there will be a time when you kind of won't even know that they've sweetened people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It won't be about a young Michelle Pfeiffer. It's just digital makeup.
Yeah. It's interesting. When I was looking at Michelle Pfeiffer, young Michelle Pfeiffer on screen, like her, you could see the red behind her eyelids. You know what I mean? I'm like, whoa, they've really nailed it. Like, I was looking for the seams, and I couldn't find them. Anyway, the de-aging technology is awesome. I agree with you, Jeff. Like, we're a couple years out from them being able to make whole films based off of younger versions of these actors, and it's just going to continue to bend reality. Okay, guys, let's talk about some of the plot details of Ant-Man and the Wasp. First of all, I think, Jeff, what you were saying earlier, I think it's you that was saying it, is that in the first film, they kind of made it a big deal, the act of shrinking down and enlarging things. Yeah. If I recall correctly, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but like, wasn't one of the reasons Dr. Hank Pym couldn't do it anymore was like because of the effect that it took on him to keep shrinking and enlarging?
Yeah.
Whereas here, and also like the idea, I always thought the idea of being able to shrink things and enlarge things was like, you have the suit that allows you to basically defy the laws of physics, because if you really shrunk down a human to that size, like, they would not function for a variety of reasons. But in this movie, they have these devices that they can throw, like, you know, Hope is driving them around in the car and they're like enlarging the car and shrinking it seemingly at will with no consequence whatsoever.
And there's even a moment very early on with one of the first action sequences with the Wasp where she's fighting a bunch of dudes and then like enlarges, I can't remember what it is, but it like blocks the doors of like a loaf of bread or something.
It was a salt shaker.
Salt shaker, right.
And I'm like, why don't you just shrink the people? Just shrink all the people you're fighting.
Well, maybe that would be dangerous. Because remember, that was like a whole plot point in the first one that like shrinking people, especially without like a helmet, is very dangerous. Like, that was
but, but
thing.
Like they're she trying doesn't, to kill
she,
you.
Yeah, she. I mean, even if it does kill
she's
them,
she's not a murderer.
I guess that's true.
She's not a murderer. She's just flipping cars over with people in them and throwing salt, gigantic salt shakers at people.
I mean, like, you know, that's one of those things, like, in the Fast and Furious movies where you're like, how many people just died there? Like, don't think about it. Don't think about it.
But, you know, if we think about the pragmatic aspects of this movie, I don't know about driving around in tiny cars in traffic.
Yeah.
It's pretty bad. It's a pretty bad idea.
Don't care. I had so much fun when they pulled out that Matchbox case, which here's my only thing about it. I loved everything about that. I think one of the best jokes in the movie is when Lewis's teeny little Matchbox car does the jump in San Francisco that every movie does in San Francisco. But then it's just, that's such a good moment. My only complaint is I guarantee you we're going to get a Matchbox car movie, and like, I don't want one. That's my only complaint. I'm going to lodge that for the future.
And while we're on things like that, does that building have no plumbing?
You can just detach it easily, right?
Yeah, and when it's re-enlarged, like, the bathroom works again.
It's a portable tank system.
I mean, like, you know, he's figured out how to get to the quantum realm. I'm sure he's, you know, maybe they have like a space station set up or something where it's like it vacuums it or something. I'm sure he's thought of something.
Yeah,
I feel like they're like, I'd like to think that there's a fan fiction out there where someone distinctly goes into how this works, and it involves three seashells.
It's always three seashells. It's always evokes for me that line from Thank You for Smoking, where Rob Lowe is like, we'll put in a line of like, it's a space thing, you know. He's just like, so great.
It's how the Force works. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. I do, but overall, I agree that this movie plays fast and loose with the rules that its predecessor set up. You know,
right,
which is kind of a bummer. Like, it's okay, the entire premise is ridiculous, but at least like try to stick by the rules that you have set up.
I don't care about that. Like, I mean, honestly, one of the things I like most about this movie is that they seem to not give a damn about what they had set up about Hope from the first movie, because like, Hope in the first movie kind of exists mostly to just nag men and just be like, Scott, you're not funny, Dad, you're a jerk, and it's just like, oh my god. And like, they give her nothing fun to do. She just is giving Scott a hard time, and then like, she checks him out once, and then they're making out. Like, I get that he looks like Paul Rudd, but their romance in the first movie doesn't work at all. And like, Hope just drove me crazy to the point where at the end, when she's like, he's like, here's your suit, and she's like, about damn time. I was like, no, thank you. Like, I didn't want to see her as the Wasp, because she was just, you know, it was just this nag stereotype that they gave her nothing to do with, except like, they needed an inside man. They needed Scott to have a love interest. So Hope Van Dyne, like, it felt so much like just a cog in the works they needed, and not like a character. But in this movie, I think that they relaxed a lot of stuff, so she made a lot more sense. For one thing, it wasn't just like, oh, we'll just throw her in Pepper Potts old clothes and like this business casual look. It was like, you know, they gave her own look. She had like this, like, she was always wearing black, and she had the hair long, and it's like, it was like inconspicuous, but still chic. And like, you know, when she starts like kicking ass, you're like, no, that makes sense. You could do that in that outfit. I buy this. And I just thought it was really smart. And like, then they even make fun of the way she used to look in the flashback with Lewis, where he's like, look at my hair, I'm all business. And I was like, yeah, that's exactly what that movie was about. Like, her whole, I mean, that's such a distillation of how that character came off. But I thought in this one, they managed to soften her edges in a lot of ways that made her a real person, instead of just this strident, shrill sexist stereotype of like, you know, here's all the guys having fun, and here's the nag just to bring us down. Like,
I will say, for the first movie, what I always read into her character is that she is rightfully angry about this loser coming in and taking the, like, and that to me, like, that was the entire movie, right? Like, that was her frustration and her working that out. But yeah, it wasn't very well written. I definitely read that into Evangeline Lilly's performance. Like, she wanted to do more, and she was constrained by this stupid script and what, you know, what they expected of this character.
Right, right. And I feel like in this, it's like, they made the Wasp a character I actually did want to see. Like, with that first fight scene, I feel like that first fight scene is like an apology to all of us that suffered through Hope Van Dyne in the first movie. And like, now we got it. We've got something interesting for her to do. And it's like, she still gives Scott shit, and she still gives her dad shit, but in a way that feels like a person, and not like someone needs to battle back with them so we can have conflict in a scene.
Yeah.
And I thought that the chemistry between her and Scott actually worked this time. Like, whether they're like, you know, joking around in a car when she's making fun of him about the Captain America thing, and she's like, Cap, or when they're in that school closet. And like, she even got a joke. Like, she makes fun of him when he's like the size of a kindergartner, and she's like, come on, you can do it. And like, I just,
that was such a great scene, and such a clever idea. Such a clever idea. Well executed.
Yeah. For the record, Christy, I'm also not bothered by them retconning Hope Van Dyne's characteristics. I'm more bothered by them retconning the fake science that they set up in the first film.
Yeah.
So
what's so funny is I rewatched that movie recently, and like, I'm like, I don't remember the fake science, but you know. I allow a lot of stuff because they're just like, oh, photon quantum realm. Sure.
Yeah. And just like, what has Michelle Pfeiffer been eating?
Right. How she survive?
Guys.
Oh, I assume those little bear bug things.
Hold on. Slow your roll, Jeff. Okay. It's very clearly set up in the first film that in the quantum realm, the normal laws of physics don't apply, right? Which presumably means like her, I don't know, rate of metabolism, all that shit is all suspended, you know?
So she should stop aging, though.
Yeah.
Good point. I retract everything I just said.
I like the idea that I love the idea that Christy puts forth that she's been just hunting tardigrades the whole time.
Thank you.
Well, no, the tardigrades are bigger. The tardigrades are bigger than the quantum realm.
But she's ferocious. So, like she's just like in the quantum realm.
She's just like tore into some quantum tardigrades and
it's all the quantum energy. And this is like the thing that I didn't quite dig from this movie, because it's not like what she was eating, but they turned her into this weird. She basically seems to have like magical quantum powers.
Yeah,
now.
She's like Jesus, quantum Jesus. Yeah. You know, like she has the quantum powers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay, guys, we need to talk about how this movie connects with Avengers.
Do we?
Infinity War. Yeah,
because it's fun. I was having so much fun with this movie. La 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 la. Mid credit scene. Oh yeah. By the way, the world is shit. Don't forget. Avengers happened, awesome. And you should feel like awful.
Well,
yeah.
First of all, what the hell, like. I don't quite think these plot lines like lined up in the record, because I think at the end of Avengers Infinity War, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Thanos like messing up Earth? Like, wasn't there some kind of Earth stuff going on?
They would have noticed something.
Yeah, like wouldn't they have noticed
some Earth stuff? Wasn't there some aliens Earth stuff going on?
Yeah, I mean, but I totally get what you're saying, but it's possible that they didn't because they're so tuned into their own thing. And like
been to San Francisco?
Yeah, they're so provincial. Like they don't look outside of San Francisco.
No, but I mean like, because like the things that are going on, it's like something happens in New York and something happens in London, but also the plot of Infinity War is only like 2 days, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's conceivable to me that like, especially, I don't remember how long Ant-Man and the Wasp lasts, but it's definitely longer than 2 days. So
gap between the end of the movie and the post-credit scene too. So,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. So maybe they knew about the crazy shit happening and didn't help.
I mean, like, yeah, maybe that wasn't their, I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. We should really, once they're presumably returned from Ash, we'll...
On that note, like, random observation, I did think that a lot of the stuff that happened, like, all the stuff between Hope and, what's his name, Scott, like, their relationship, a lot of it felt like it took place off screen, right? Am I correct about that?
Yeah.
I thought that was an interesting choice. Like, this whole thing about, like, him going to do that... Captain America Civil War battle, like that was a major inflection point in their relationship. Whereas in that movie, it's tossed off as kind of a oh hey, we found this dude, you know, and like he appears in the back of a van or whatever.
It's so nice that there are consequences for what happens in Civil War. The entire movie is about him, or it starts with him being under house arrest, which I think great montage, and also I love it when sequels deal with consequences. So
And I also like that it's like the story picked up where it gets interesting. And not like, well, now let's give you a tedious scene where they have a fight or whatever. Like, we didn't need that. And like, you know, instead you get like Lewis explaining it, which that sequence, it is my favorite sequence. Like, I just want Michael Pena to be in every Marvel movie doing one sequence.
And honestly, that sequence is great. And wasn't there one in the first movie too? Yes. Like his superpower. That's his superpower is to like tell the story in that wonderful way. I love that.
I just love, by the way, I just love thinking about how they filmed it, which is obviously they had Michael Pena say the whole thing, and then they had to play back the audio of Michael like Pena while they're filming it so that the lips line up. I just it tickles me to think
it's
of
like
how
shooting
they
a music
it.
Video. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, Jeff, what did you say?
I was going to say, as far as the ramifications for the greater Marvel Universe, cinematic universe, I really like the fact that this really sets up Ant-Man as being potentially a pivotal character for saving the universe.
Yes.
You know, which is pretty rad that, you know, we get some indication that he has the ability in the quantum realm to time travel and that there is going to be, you know, Ant-Man could be the linchpin of the entire thing that Doctor Strange saw, you know, that works.
Yeah, people doubted it because he wasn't even in the poster for Avengers Infinity War. But right. It is kind of hilarious that he might be the key to solving the whole thing. For those who don't know, by the way, we should just say what happens in the post-credit scenes, which is that they build a miniature quantum time tunnel in the back of a van. It sounds insane that I'm saying all this. And they send Scott Lang through into the quantum realm. So that he can pick up some quantum energies.
I assume because...
The healing particles.
Yes.
I assume because Michelle Pfeiffer is super hungry and wants some delicious
particles.
Also
ghosts.
That.
Yeah.
He's
also
going hunting for provisions.
All she can eat now, she has a taste for it, and she wants to share with everybody.
You get that sweet bugbear meat once, you need it again.
So, anyway, they send him through, and then while he's in the quantum realm, before he can be extracted from the quantum tunnel, it cuts to the outside where they're manning the machines, and you find out Hope Van Dyne, Hank Pym, and Michelle Pfeiffer's character,
Janet Van Dyne,
mm-hmm. have all been vanished to ash, as with many of the characters at the end of Avengers Infinity War. So that's what happens at the end of this. Shocked. Yeah. Reactions in my theater, and I thought it was like a lot of people are down on it. I've seen Devendra's reaction a couple times online. I thought it was delightful. I thought it was.
It made me mad, but I also saw that coming.
I thought it was like, oh my gosh, like that is such a clever way of tying the movies in together and of figuring out a way for Scott Lang to avoid getting vaporized.
I believe it was during our review.
Yes, you predicted it. Didn't you predict it, Jeff Cannata? Mm-hmm.
I did.
You called it.
It'll be hilarious if we have this really fun, delightful, happy thing at the end of it. It's like, wow, what a crazy Ant-Man adventure. And then half of them disappear into dust.
Yeah.
So here's what's funny.
Which is so basically what happened.
Yeah.
I have a piece up on Sci-Fi Fangirls now about then, like, after that, they give you, like, something funny at the very end of credits to kind of lighten the mood again. And I said that, like, I have one major beef with this movie, aside from Too Little Michelle Forever. And it is that end scene should have been Luis instead of just an ant drumming. Because one, the joke is done. We've had that joke. It's tired. It's cute, but we've been there. But two, Luis sets up that he really wants a super suit. And I wanted that last scene to just be him sneaking around in the Ant-Man suit.
Yeah.
And for bonus fun times to ease my ailing soul once you've Infinity Warred me all over again. One, Luis is, we know he's not dead. Two, he's in the Ant-Man suit, so hooray, call back on that joke. Three, make it the faulty one, so when he does the shrinking thing, he's just, like, child-sized, and that's where it ends. Like, that'd be hilarious.
You should be writing these post-credit screens.
I'm just saying, Marvel, yeah. I'm available. but no, and then what I wanted to point out about the other thing that happens in the mid-credit scene is that Janet warns Scott about the time vortex, which we talked about a little. And, like, so he could be jumping around in time. He could be, and I talk about this more at length in another sci-fi piece coming up, he could be maybe jumping back to the 90s when Captain Marvel said.
Yeah. I definitely expect that at this point.
Can I say a crazy theory?
Yeah, predict that, Captain Marvel for us, Jeff Cannata.
Well, no, this is not Captain Marvel theory. I hesitate to say this.
You're in it now.
What if the Ant-Man has been in things the whole time, but we just haven't been able to see him because he was tiny?
Ooh.
And that the reveal is scenes shot from older movies, older Marvel movies, revealing the fact that there's been a tiny Ant-Man in them the whole time.
Futurama thing, too, where, like, the Nibbler thing, like, I think you can just, like, pretend like he was there the whole time, too, in certain respects.
Yeah.
Could be good, Jeff. Could also be, like, Spectre, James Bond. It's me, yeah. James, the author of all your pain. It makes no sense, you know? could be.
No,
could
I
be
don't
that.
Think. That, yeah. Okay. It could be that. But I think that could be an amazing. Yeah. You have someone super tiny who's trying to. I don't know. It could be great
if they show that he actually had like a key role in each of those films. They could be good.
Yeah.
He's just hanging out in Coulson's pocket.
Or you know, like every time like the shield bounced back to Captain America, it was him that was throwing it because that shield should not act in that way. It defies laws of physics.
Yeah. Physics. Yeah.
Jeff, do you care to make any other predictions before we wrap up about like? Do you think, in fact, that Ant-Man's going to be the cause of solving all this Thanos stuff?
I think he's going to play a very much larger role in it than we had originally thought.
Yeah.
We would think, yeah.
Because we originally thought he would play no role in it. Right?
Well, I didn't think he would play no role. I thought he would be. I was hoping he would be like he and Hawkeye would be back mm-hmm. for the next Avengers movie, and I still think that. I think that I think it's going to be interesting to see how they play this out. But what is certain is that he has a much more potent power base than we thought. Right now, he has the ability because of tapping into the quantum realm. That is a much more potent, much more possible impact on mm-hmm. the world, and I think that's going to be really exciting to see.
Indeed, indeed. All right. Well, let's wrap it up there. You can find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us. Let us know what you thought of Ant-Man and the Wasp at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our theme song comes from adamwarrock.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be discussing next week. In the meantime, Christy Puchko, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
Well, I write all over the web. I write every day at pajiba.com, but you can find career highlights at decadentcriminals.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at Christy Puchko. That's KristyPuchko. And keep an eye out because I'm going to be hitting Fantasia Film Festival in Montreal soon, and I'm going to be having tons of reviews of really weird genre stuff coming out of it. Nice. I'm pretty excited.
Oh, man, yeah. Jealous. Yeah, heard that's a great fest. Time. Jeff Cannata.
Poutine and weird movies. Good times.
Jeff Cannata, where can people find more of your work?
You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And I do a video game show called DLC, which you can find at 5by5.tv/DLC.
How about you, Devendra?
You can find me on Twitter at Devendra, and I write about tech at Engadget.com.
Find all my stuff at twitter.com/DaveChensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y, and DaveChen.net. You can also find my video review and my written review of AMC Stubbs A-List at DaveChen.net and slashfilm.com. All right. Next week, you know, guys, sometimes I like to give you a little insight into the horse trading that takes place in behind the scenes of the Slash Film Cast.
Horse trading?
And that horse trading happened this week when Devendra almost refused to review Skyscraper. But I said, you know what, Devendra, I'll throw you a bone. I'll review The Meg with you if you do Skyscraper.
I mean, so, we were going to review The Meg anyway.
Everybody wins in this scenario.
So we are going to review Skyscraper next week. Jeff Cannata, it's a movie you've already seen, right? I think it's going
to
be a good episode.
I saw it last night. I cannot wait to talk about it with you guys. Also, I found out the name of the web series that I was in with Randall Park. It's called Ground Game.
Nice. Good job. Nice callback, Jeff. Nice callback.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for listening.
I just want to throw out, I've also seen Skyscraper, and I'm very excited that it's going to be reviewed on the show. So much.
I mean, guys, I have waited so long to see Die Hard in a building.
Die Hard in a building, guys.
Oh, Devendra,
you're going to eat your words. You don't even know. You don't even know. That's all I'm going to say.
I hope it's fun.
Guys, this is the perfect...
But you're going to eat your words.
The perfect movie to use AMC Stubbs A-List for. I'm just going to put that
Oh, you betcha. You betcha. I have that reserved. It's already reserved. Yeah.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. He watched the